Well, there you go. That was fun. I love a good thriller with a twist. And I think we can all appreciate the good work that our new best friend, Kevin McDonald, has done on this film. Now, obviously, I was talking a little bit before about Kevin and his almost meteoric rise to stardom as an international director of the highest caliber. But, of course, he won't tell it like that. He'll tell you about the hard struggle, the mean streets, the Scottish boarding schools. But I think probably the best person to tell story of Kevin McDonald is Kevin McDonald. So we've got him on the phone right now. Can you hear me, Kevin McDonald?
I can. I'm not sure if I like that description of myself, but I'm here nonetheless. I'm in London.
Well, welcome to Popcorn Taxi.
Hi. Nice to talk to you.
Well, it's a pleasure and an honour to talk to you, Kevin. And if you could, please set the record straight. Who is the real Kevin McDonald?
Well, I'm not quite sure what that means, but there used to be, I remember on IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, you know, which I'm sure many of the people there have used on the internet, you know, find out the biography of filmmakers. There used to be under my name, there were two careers. There was an actor called Kevin McDonald and a director called Kevin McDonald. I used to quite like the fact that I was also apparently an actor. I wasn't an actor, but because this Kevin McDonald, whoever he was, had a lot of parts as third drug dealer from the left and that kind of thing, which I could never have got. So, what can I tell you?
Well, Kevin, tell us, I guess, the first thing that many of our audience members would know, that the difference between documentary filmmaking and feature filmmaking with actors isn't as huge a gap as it may seem. And obviously the transition that you've slowly made from documentaries to the feature film format has been a gradual one, but not one that's been a huge shock to the system. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to know first off is, what's the difference when you're dealing with trying to get a real person to give a performance out of editing and trying to get an actor to give a real person out of editing?
Well, I always sort of say that actually, you know, when I'm making a documentary, you know, you're taking real life and real people and you're trying to make them seem more fictional. And you're trying to find the great narrative within the chaos of real life. Trying to find shape and meaning in the chaos of real life, whereas in fiction films, you're trying to do the opposite, or I'm trying to do the opposite. I'm trying to find the truth and the reality and the spontaneous and the things that feel documentary in a fictional story. So for me, the two things are very similar. And I when making a fiction film, as I've now done two, I try to ground the film in, with the case of Last King of Scotland, in, you know, the real Uganda and a lot of the places where events that we were describing that film took place, and trying to have something very authentic and very sort of specific and textured. And in the case of State of Play, trying to show people a view of Washington, D.C., one of the most filmed places in the world, that is different than what they've hopefully seen before, and grounded more in the reality. Because I just believe that, you know, reality is usually much more interesting than anything you can make up. And I also, when I work on the set, I try to incorporate some of my documentary kind of sensibility. And I like to try a lot of things out. I try to get the actors to improvise a bit, and you know, try it like this, try it like that, and then really put it together in the cutting room in the same way as I would on a documentary, sort of find the final film in the cutting room.
Now, obviously, the actors that you have were real Hollywood top guns, and but from very different schools of acting. Obviously, you've got Helen Mirren, Russell Crowe, Ben Affleck, Robin Wright, and, of course, Rachel McAdams. Did you have to kind of go to school every time that you dealt with every single actor, or did you find oddly similar acting styles within disparate personalities?
They did have very different acting styles. There's no doubt about it. I mean, for one extreme, you know, one of the great things that working on a big Hollywood production is that you have the money to be able to hire great, great actors even in small parts. So, you know, I've got Helen Mirren in a part which is, I don't know, six scenes or something like that, and I've got maybe a little more than that, and I've got Jeff Daniels in four scenes, and you know, someone like Jeff, and the same goes for Helen, they're just great professionals. You know, they've usually come up through theatre. They're kind of jobbing actors to a degree, even though they are also stars, and they just enjoy the craft and the job of it. And then you have actors like Russell, obviously, who's a very intense and kind of more, I wouldn't say methody, but you know, he certainly gets emotionally involved in a way in his work and in the parts. And he likes to, you know, he figures out exactly what he wants to do, and he comes on set and he does two or three takes, and that's sort of him done. He doesn't really want to have to do any more than that. He's done everything he's got in him. And then you have Ben Affleck, who really needs to do a lot of takes and needs to explore a lot. So there's a lot of difficulty between him and Russell on set. You know, it's quite tricky getting one to peak at the same time as the other to peak, or you know, making it. You know, if the actor you're acting opposite is on take 15, you can get quite bored if you're Russell Crowe. So that's and likewise the other way around for Ben. It was very difficult having an actor who comes on and does it perfectly twice and that's it. So, yeah, I mean, you know, actors are unusual people. they're not like the rest of us, I sometimes think. And one of the wonders and joys of making fiction films is, you know, you're just constantly learning about the psychology of actors and the psychology of, well, I guess the psychology of human beings and how to get the best out of them, how to get something that feels honest and truthful. And sometimes you don't really know what you think you haven't got something, you haven't got performance, but actually you look at the rushes and you think, oh my God, it's there. And there's a sort of magic in that.
Now,
I certainly remember with Forrest Whitaker, you know, one of the things with him when we did Last King of Scotland was, I, having never done a fiction film before, I thought that I didn't have the performance from him. And then it was only when we put it together in the cutting room and took a little bit of that take and a bit of that take, and you thought, oh my God, he has, he's given it to us, but it's just not... It's not all in one take. And I think a lot of movie actors are like that. They don't necessarily give it to you all in one take.
Right. Obviously somebody like Russell Crowe is part of, I wouldn't say it's a Hollywood system, but it allows personalities of enormous quality to exist. Did you find yourself a little bit intimidated, or did Russell scare you a little bit?
Of course. You'd be inhuman if Russell didn't scare you more than a little bit. you know, Russell came in very late into this film, and he was kind of our savior in some ways, because Brad Pitt was meant to be starring in that role, pulled out for various reasons at the last minute, and you know, I didn't want to let the film go down. I thought this was the kind of movie I wanted to make, and the studio were behind it, and so we sort of got together, had a meeting, and decided, you know, who do we want? And I said, well, Russell, he is the greatest actor of that sort of age group, and with the star caliber that we required in order to, you know, financially justify the movie. And so we sent the script to Russell. 2 days later, he got back to me. He said, you know, I think something like, I think it's a, you know, interesting film. I'd like to talk to you about it more. Two things you have to know about me: I can be difficult on the set, and I don't break my turnaround for the Pope. If you're still interested, come to Sydney. So I got on the plane to Sydney and went to see him. And we spent an interesting day together talking about the part, talking about the film. And he signed on, and that was fantastic. And then he committed himself to it, you know, really fully. And the great thing about Russell is that he is an actor first and foremost, you know, he's, rather than a movie star. He really is into who is this character? How can I portray him with the most depth possible? He's not vain in any way. He doesn't worry about, you know, I'm, you know, is this a heroic moment for me, or you know, anything like that.
Now, when you were operating in these kind of rarefied atmospheres, one can quote Orson Welles and saying it's like having the world's biggest train set. Was it fun to get Helen Mirren to say fuck you very much?
Yeah, that's my favourite line in the movie. Actually, Tony Gilroy came up with that line. Yeah, I mean, the thing about Helen Mirren in particular is, you know, she hates the idea that everyone thinks of her as this very polite, class-bound English woman who's the queen, really.
She's not really.
You know,
she's a bit
rough.
She's
not like that at all. She's a rebel. She's a sort of, you know, wouldn't say an old hippie, but she's got something of that about her. You know, she's a free thinker and a free lover and a free actor and everything. And, you know, so she used to love coming on set. And, you know, even before we'd started shooting, she'd come and sort of look around the set, look at her office and see whether she liked the furniture or whatever. And she would just swear like a trooper. I mean, it was just unbelievable. Every swear word you can possibly imagine and a few more that you've never heard of would just come pouring out of it. So, and you could see her sort of twinkling, her eye twinkling, and sort of looking around to see how the American crew, who were rather polite farm boys, how they were reacting to this, and she adored it.
Now, obviously, the film has been cut together very well, and it's a remarkable piece of, I guess, thrillerism. But there's always elements where you have to give the audience what they want and not necessarily what you want. There's some fairly bombastic moments within the film. Did you find yourself creating a commercial piece of work, or did you find yourself a slave to the very best story you could make?
Well, I think that, you know, you're making a film for a huge amount of money within the studio system, and you have to, in a sense, be thinking about the audience and thinking about, you know, a wide audience and not just a kind of art house audience. And so there are certain pressures that come with that, and pressures from the studio to do things in a certain way. And I think there are certain things in this movie, small things that, you know, I feel I would have done slightly differently if I had a total free rein. But, you know, I think that's the great thing about movies in a way, and the curse of movies at the same time, is that it's art and commerce locked in a tussle to the death. And you have to try and find a happy marriage between them. And you know, I'd say 95% of this movie I like very much, and I think is you know, what I would want it to have been under any circumstances. I think a much harder thing was, you know, making a movie where you don't have the original star you thought you were going to have. You're sort of changing the cast at the last minute. When we were making it, there was a writer's strike, and so any changes, it was very difficult to make changes to the film. Those sort of political problems are actually featured much more largely in my mind when I was making it, in terms of the problematic sides of it. But, you know, when you're working with such fantastic actors, and when you're working with the great train set, as Orson Welles said, of Hollywood Studio, it's great fun and a great feeling to be working with, you know, technicians, for instance, who are the best, who really are, you know, the A team, and everything happens like in a flash, and there's no complaints, there's no, oh, we don't think we can do that, or we don't have the money to do that, whatever. And that's a fantastic feeling.
Now, obviously, you've been quoted, in a general terms on the internet about Brad Pitt and his involvement and his separation from the role, in the sense that he was a little too slick for the part and not quite right in the casting. And it was him and his production company that brought it to you, and you, I guess, in a sense, took it away from him and then, you know, pushed his face in the dirt and said, thanks,
well,
Brad, we're moving on.
That makes sense.
But what actually happened? No. I mean, was he just rubbish and just said, look, I need an actor, not just some face?
Take the film away from him. That sounds a little harsh. I think, he and his company sort of brought the project to me, and I liked it, but felt just that there was work that needed to be done on the script. And particularly because I knew the original TV series on which this is based, I knew it quite well. And very much liked it, and so I was for a while just doubtful about whether I wanted to remake something that I liked so much. I think that's, you know, people tend to do remakes of bad things, and when they do remakes of good things, it sometimes doesn't work out so well. But I felt that I had to put my own mark on it, and I think as a director, that's what you're employed to do. And so I started working with another writer, with Tony Gilroy, and we started changing the script. And really, I think Brad and I could never find a script that we both agreed on. The way that I wanted to take it, just was slightly different than the way he wanted to take it. But I think, and this is maybe what you're referring to on the internet, that what I've said is that I felt that Brad was in some way never suited to the role, and that Russell is far better suited to the role, and they ended up with the right man for the job, as it were. One of the key components of casting this film is the dynamic between the politician and the journalist. And the politician has to be more glossy, has to be more successful, more ambitious. He needs to be more sexy, probably. He's got the girl, after all, in this sort of competition between the two old friends. And it was very hard to see Brad Pitt being the loser in that situation. It's very hard to see him looking up to anybody else and thinking, you know, you've done better in life than I have. And feeling that Brad Pitt had lost his ambition and lost the girl, it was hard to envisage that. And I think, you know, although I didn't articulate it like that at the time, and I think he didn't articulate it at that time, I think that was at the bottom of why we couldn't make the script work to both of our satisfaction.
Now we're going to be opening up the microphone to our audience members, who are exceptionally well-versed in film lore and, of course, the works of Kevin MacDonald. So be prepared for some excellent questions. But before I do that, I'm going to ask you one more question, which is, your films have an extraordinarily visceral quality, from touching the void, where you can actually feel the frostbite, to smelling the spit of Idi Amin, to having to go through that opening sequence of running through the streets of Washington. Mm-hmm. What is it, do you think, that you do that gives that visceral quality to your films?
I think it's the documentary side of me. I think it's sort of trying to be honest. And I think when you try and do something in an honest way, it can sometimes be uncomfortable. But it can also be, as you say, very visceral, because it cuts to the point. And I think that's probably what it is. It's one of those things that people often say to me, the films are very visceral, but it's not something that I think I consciously set out to do. I think, you know, as a filmmaker, you set out to tell the story in the best way that you can. And I think I approach films, and whether they're documentaries or fiction films, as stories, as how can I suck the audience in here, and how can I really make them want to know what happens next and want to know what happens to these characters. So somehow the offshoot of that is this visceral quality.
Right. So, we have a question? Or shall I lead on because I'm just so good at it? All right. Oh, wait, we do have questions.
Could you tell me, did you have rehearsal, and if so, how much?
I didn't hear the question.
Did you have rehearsal, and if so, how much?
Unfortunately, because of this film was sort of a bit of a Hollywood mishmash and a mess at the beginning, because of the Brad pulling out and Russell coming in very much at the last minute, I didn't really have any rehearsal. By the time Russell arrived, I think he came on a Friday and we started on the Monday, and I think I spent, you know, part of Saturday, part of Sunday or something like that with him and with some of the other actors. We never even had a read-through of the script, which was not something I would recommend to anybody. I think, you know, this was not the ideal preparation for a movie. So I would love to have had more. And on Last King of Scotland, I had 2 weeks of rehearsals. And on the film I'm just about to start now, I've scheduled at the moment to have two weeks of rehearsals. And I think it's absolutely key. I think, especially if you're doing something which is quite character-based, obviously, because you need to have all those big questions that the actors invariably have, and quite rightly have, about the script, about their character. You need to answer those in advance. Otherwise, you can spend, as I did on State of Play, you can spend hours of a morning wasting time discussing stuff, which needs to be worked out, needs to be figured out. But, you know, for the fairness of the actor and their portrayal, but you don't want to be having a crew of 150 sitting around while you're talking to your actors. So rehearsal, I think, is absolutely vital, and also the script changes quite radically for me in the things I've done. When you rehearse, you know, you realize that a scene doesn't work the way you had it, or this line doesn't work, or this exchange doesn't work, and you know, it needs to go more like this. Until you hear the real people saying it, it's hard to know whether the script works or not.
All right, we have another question up the back here.
Kevin, hi. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it very much, as I did the original BBC series several years ago now. I'm interested to know, first of all, do you hope that the film will focus attention more perhaps on the privatization of the American military, and which does exist, which is has happened. And would you like
to... One of the things that I wanted to do in the film was to have a conspiracy thriller, which in a way turns out not to be a conspiracy thriller, but to have the conspiracy at the heart of this to be totally real, and basically everything that they say about privatization of the of the military, but also of the internal sort of spy network, the FBI, CIA, that's all absolutely true, and basically there's very little even exaggeration within that side of the film.
Do you hope the film will make a difference? And also, my other question is, would you have been interested, or are you still interested, in making a documentary on the subject?
I'm not interested in making a documentary on that subject, I have to say. I'd like to carry on making documentaries, and I'm talking to somebody about making one at the moment. After the current film I'm doing is a fiction film, but I would definitely like to be able to do.
If you entered into this subject matter, you might not be able to make documentaries at all because they might rub you out.
They might well rub you out. I mean, you know, it's a highly controversial area. But I think, you know, when we made this film under George Bush, things were somewhat different. And I think, you know, it's a mistake to think that privatization is going to go away. For me, the subject was not just about the privatization of the armed forces, but about the whole subject of privatization, of things which should be under government control, or should be things that should be done for reasons other than, you know, pounds, shillings and pence, or dollars and cents, whatever you have over there. There should be more people should have different values than just the financial values, and that in a sense was more what I was interested in, rather than the specific instance of the privatization of the military. But I think that the issue that I really wanted to get at was about newspapers and the importance of newspapers and the death of newspapers. And it was sort of fascinating to make a film in America in particular, where I don't know what the situation is in Australia, but in America and in the UK, newspapers are in terrible crisis. And you know, in America, a lot are closing down. A lot of big cities no longer have a newspaper, or shortly won't have a newspaper. And because there's no real national print media outside of the magazines like Newsweek and Time, but there's no national newspapers as such, that means that there will be whole communities who'd really have no access to reliable news, because we all know what American television news is like. It's absolutely dire. So that was the issue that really grabbed my attention as somebody who came from documentaries and came from a sort of interest in journalism.
We have another question.
Kevin, I'm interested in the process of the writing of the script, or more particularly your collaboration with the writers. There was quite a number of writers, and I'm interested in what that was like for you as a director to work with different writers, and what the development of the script was over that period of time.
Well, again, I wouldn't recommend the Hollywood way of working on these things, which is that, you know, they throw writers at a project. But none of those writers have a real kind of commitment to it emotionally, because they're often on a weekly rate. So you have somebody who comes on for a month or comes on for 2 months, and they get paid by the week. And then when their time is up, they're gone, and they've sort of, you know, they've moved on from that project. And I think that's no way to really write a screenplay. And this was a very interesting sort of scenario, because we had a start date, which was around Brad Pitt's availability. And, you know, developing a script is not a linear thing. You can't say, oh, if we've got 3 months, I'll be able to sort everything out. It's a kind of circuitous thing. You have to try things out and fill around. So it was, I the main writer I worked with was Tony Gilroy, who's a wonderful writer, who did the Bourne films, who directs now, did Duplicity and Michael Clayton. And he and I spent almost 2 months together working on it, and very closely working, sitting, discussing every aspect of the story. And unfortunately, that was the script that Brad didn't like. So of course, in order to try and keep him on board, and the film wasn't going to happen without him, I moved on to another writer who did 3 or 4 weeks' work before the writer's strike started, and that was Billy Ray. But it's a very specifically Hollywood and American attitude that somehow that you know a writer can come on for 3 or 4 weeks and can really do very valuable work in that time. I think all they can really do is to change the dialogue a little bit, shift things around a little bit. They can't really deal with the fundamentals. And so the fundamentals of the script were always what Tony Gilroy and I had worked on, and that was the stuff, unfortunately, that my reluctant star didn't agree with.
We have another question.
Yes, I noticed in the credits that Dante Spinotti was credited with additional cinematography and that you also had shot Genesis in film. Was just wondering kind of what was what. And
well, I was very lucky to have Dante, and not everybody gets to have Dante Spinotti do their additional photography. Yeah, no, we did 4 or 5 days of reshoots on the film, and unfortunately Rodrigo Prieto, who shot the rest of the movie, fantastic Mexican DP, he wasn't available. He was shooting the Almodovar film in Spain. So luckily Dante was at a loose end, and that was a wonderful experience because for those of you who don't know, he's one of the great cinematographers, Italian originally, but has worked in America and most famously with Michael Mann, I think most of Michael Mann's best looking movies. So that was fascinating for me to get to work with him. And it's a very different approach actually to Rodrigo, so that was interesting. Rodrigo and I decided that we wanted to differentiate between the world of politics and the sort of slick, telegenic world of Stephen Collins, the Ben Affleck character, and the grittier, more humanist kind of world of Russell Crowe, of Cal McCaffrey. And we thought it would be interesting to have that differentiation be partly in the movement of the camera and the use of the camera, the camera angles, but also in the actual medium that we shot on. So we decided we would shoot that on a digital medium. We tested a lot of different digital cameras, and we decided on the Genesis. In the end, I'm not sure how much people actually notice it, to be honest. I think it's a subliminal. I think somebody who is a DP will probably notice that the political scenes are shot on digital, but I think most other people probably don't. I think they probably notice more the change in camera style.
Now we have another question.
Kevin, I just want to ask, it's sort of like a point of difference between how you work. When you're doing your documentaries, there must be certain personal triggers or checkboxes that you have where you go, oh, I like this, yes, this is going to work. How does that differ from when you're doing fiction, which you've done twice?
So I don't quite understand the question.
All right. What turns you on about making a documentary, and what turns you on about making a feature fiction film, and what are the differences?
Well, I think that you know, when I make a documentary, I tend to start from an interest in the subject matter, you know, and as opposed to when you're doing a fiction film, it really is about the story. You know, what's the story and who are the characters? And I think one of the things I love about documentary is the fact that you're allowed to make mistakes. You can go off and film a load of stuff and then think, oh, actually, you know what? I'm not going to use that. I've gone down the wrong route. Whereas in fiction, obviously, that's harder, and you know, everything ought to be scripted and pre-planned. And that side of things I find sometimes restrictive. On the other hand, when you're working on a fiction film, you know, you can focus much more on the kind of the actual filmmaking and on the craft of using the camp and using sound and using music, and you know, that's a lot of what it is to be a filmmaker is getting better and better at using the craft of filmmaking. And so, you know, I've learned a huge amount on the two films that I've done, and I'm sure we'll go on learning. Although ultimately, I sort of do think that. I do think that it doesn't actually matter if you're not very good technically. If you've got a good story to tell and great performances, people will forgive almost anything, is my experience.
Now, obviously, your third feature film or your third story is coming up. And am I correct in supposing that it is called Eagle of the Ninth?
Yeah, no, that's right. It's based on a book that I loved as a sort of teenager, which is about the relationship between a Roman soldier in the 2nd century AD in Britain. There's a relationship between a Roman soldier who's invalided out of the Roman army and his Celtic slave, and they go on a kind of quest journey together. It's an attempt to try and do a intimate, character-driven Roman film, which nobody, you know, it's the opposite of Russell's Gladiator in a way. It's not about huge set pieces. It's about a relationship. And the film that I've compared it to a lot is The Searchers, the John Ford classic western. It's somewhat similar to that.
So, did you find yourself accidentally dropping the script into Russell's inbox during shooting?
No, I didn't. I think he's too expensive for this project. One thing about Russell, I don't think he likes cutting his rate too much. Now, you know, I think that this is a smaller scale film. I think people tend to do kind of movies set in the classical period, set in the, you know, the Roman or Greek period. They tend to think they have to be epic. And I thought, well, why? Why can't we just do a rather small scale intimate film set in that period? I mean, it has got its moments, bigger moments, but most of those are to do with the adventure story of two people riding across the Scottish landscape in search of their quest.
Now, I think to finish up, we'll go from the sublime to the ridiculous, where I find myself most comfortable. And I'm going to ask you, as the only Oscar winner in our current conversation, can you tell me what it's like? Do you just hint at the fact that you're an Oscar winner when you're dealing with Hollywood, and just let that little golden statue pop up as you discuss who gets the biggest trailer or how much money you get or how you're going to be treated by the producers?
No, I mean, I don't. First of all, I think, you know, I was working on a film this last time with a whole bunch of Oscar winners. I think, you know,
did you have coffee together and have like an Oscar winners club?
Oh, you know, they're all there. But also, you know, my Oscar's for a documentary, and in Hollywood, as we all know, documentaries are—they're not just the poor relation. They're something below that. They're the bastard child, and nobody has very much interest or respect in documentaries. I think, although funnily enough, actually, it's actors I tend to find really respond to documentaries, and that's the reason I got involved with doing a film with Brad Pitt, was because he actually liked very much a documentary I did, Touching the Void. So it shouldn't be said that people dismiss them completely. But no, I mean, I have to say, it's not something I think about very much. I do have my Oscar sitting next to me as we're speaking. It's on my desk behind me, and but I don't think about it every night or anything. Although it's odd in America, you know, that I often think that in Britain you get a knighthood, you know, when you've done well in your career. In America you get an Oscar, and it's the same thing. It qualifies your life for the rest of, you know, your career from then on. You know, in American newspapers, if ever mention you, you're known as Oscar winner Kevin MacDonald. Like Sir Kevin MacDonald would be the British equivalent.
Well, Kevin, as a non-Oscar winner, it is a pleasure to be part of your wonderful and slightly wonderful and weird journey through Hollywood and hopefully beyond. We're looking very much forward to your next films, and thank you very much for all the good work that you put in your past films, and congratulate you on State of Play.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Well, would you please thank Mr. Oscar Hillestrom for being a great host tonight. Very witty. And hopefully we'll see you all again next Monday when we go into a whole different world of gorillas with bananas. Cheers. Get home safe. Thanks.